Namo Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato. Sama Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato. Sama Sambuddhasa. Buddhaṃ Dhammaṃ Sanghaṃ Namassāmi. Sound right? This is a new microphone, so I'm not sure how far away I should be. Is that okay? As most of you would probably be aware, the Buddhist Society has established a forest monastery for nuns at Gijiganath, and I'm the senior nun there. I'm the abbot. And at the moment, I'm the only nun, but we do have plans that eventually the nuns' monastery will be the same as the monks' monastery at Serpentine, that we'll have 20 nuns, or nuns in training, living in kutis, little huts in the forest, and we'll also have accommodation for short-term female and male guests. At the moment we have started work on our first permanent building, and that should be ready for occupancy in December, and our first trainee nun will be coming in January. So things are happening up there. And I've been asked tonight to talk about the nun's life and where nuns fit in with the monks, and how the nuns' practice compares with the practice of the monks and the life that they live. So first of all, I think there are a few important things to just be aware of in talking about nuns. I have given a talk previously about the history of nuns, so I'm not going to go into detail about that. But it's important to remember that the nuns' order was started by the Buddha himself. And when he started the nuns' order, he stated quite clearly that women have the same potential to develop spiritually as men do, and they have the same capacity to attain full enlightenment, complete liberation from suffering, given the same opportunity to lead the homeless life. So at the beginning we have to remember that what we're doing here in Perth is not something that's a modern invention, and it was given full sanction by the Buddha. And so when we think about what is the purpose of the nun's life, we have to recognize that the purpose of the nun's life is the same as the purpose of the monk's life, and that is to attain nibbana. And in a sutta, a teaching which the Buddha gave in the middle length discourses, he talked about the goal of the holy life, the brahmacharya life, the homeless life, the monastic life. And he said that the homeless life is not lived in order to acquire fame and gain. And when you look around at perhaps the place here or the monastery in Serpentine, or you look at monks or nuns sitting up here and people bowing to them, you might think, well, that's a pretty good show, that one, getting up there and having people listen to you and pay respect. But that is not what this holy life is about. And it's not about developing virtue and being a good person, although that's an essential part of the path of practice. And it's not about developing concentration and being able to sit in bliss. That's one of the fruits of the practice, but it's not the goal. And the goal isn't even to develop wisdom and knowledge to really understand what life is about. Because you can develop a deep understanding of things, but still be attached to them, even though you know that they're not going to bring you ultimate happiness. So the Buddha said, these are parts of the path, and these are the fruits of the practice, but the goal of the holy life, its essence, is complete liberation of the mind, complete liberation from greed, hatred and delusion, complete liberation from old age, sickness and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. So that's pretty good going, isn't it, to have all those things as your purpose. And in this particular teaching, the Buddha talked about the heartwood of the practice being like the heartwood of the tree, the very pith of the tree, the very best wood. And this is why we've called the nun's monastery Dharmasara, because the Dharmasara means the heartwood of the Dharma, the essence of the Dharma. The very core of what we're trying to do is to attain complete liberation from suffering. And so we've called Dharmasara Dharmasara, Nun's Monastery, to remind each of us who are involved with it that we're not there for anything less than complete liberation. And that's, of course, the goal for the monks as well. But it's important for us to realise that this path, and particularly the monastic life, isn't about adding things on to make our life more pleasant. And in talking about the monastic life, as lay people you might wonder, well, what does that mean for me? What relevance does it have for me? Because I've got no intention of becoming a monk or a nun. But it does have relevance if you have started on this path of practice. Because first of all, it shows you the direction that you are heading in, the goal of the life, whether you're practicing as a lay person or not, or a lay person or a monastic. And having the monastic form and having monastics around and seeing the way that they practice and the way that they live gives you some indication of where you need to go in your own practice and in your own lifestyle, in your own priorities, in your own values, if you also want to taste that taste of freedom. And so that's why this talk is relevant for you, even if you're not thinking about undertaking the holy life. So moving from the fact that the nun's order was started by the Buddha himself, and that women are just as capable as men are of becoming fully enlightened given the good conditions of practicing the homeless life, we also have to understand that the direct lineage of the nun's ordination and the standardized form that the nuns follow and the opportunity for higher ordination for nuns was disrupted when in the 11th century all the nuns existing at that time died out. They were either killed or they died as a result of famine or because their parents forcibly removed them from the nunneries because they were worried for their well-being. And with the dying out of those nuns who were practicing in the direct lineage from the Buddha, we now face the fact in today's society that we don't have a standardized form to follow in the nuns' monastery here in Perth. From the time that the lineage died out, women in various Theravada Buddhist countries have taken on varying numbers of precepts or training rules and following guidelines established by the Buddha and also following the model of the monastic life as lived by the monks, women have had to reinvent the monastic life for themselves, if you like, because that direct connection has died out. So what that means for us here in Perth is that we face the challenge of developing a monastic form for the nuns, which is going to be true to the purpose of the monastic life, that is to practice for the attainment of nirvana, but which is appropriate, relevant to the situation that we live in today. This is a challenge, but it also is an opportunity. And one of the reasons why we can't just resurrect the full ordination or the bhikkhuni ordination that the Buddha set out is because the hierarchy in some Theravada Buddhist countries don't recognize that lineage as being available any longer. And also, if we look at the rules that the nuns lived under at the time of the Buddha, we may see that some of them are no longer really appropriate in today's situation. So, for example, nuns in the time of the Buddha were prohibited from living in the forest and prohibited from living alone, not because of their misconduct or the fact that it wasn't good for their practice, it was good for their practice, but because they were raped and assaulted by laymen, and even enlightened nuns were raped. And so the Buddha made the rule that all the nuns' monasteries should be within the bounds of the city and not out in the forest. But if we think today of our contemporary situation and the fact that we want to give women the same opportunities and the same favourable conditions for their practice, then it wouldn't be considered appropriate not to give them the opportunity to live in the forest and to practice in the conditions which are most conducive to developing calm and insight. And so this is one of the things that we have to look at, that the rules of the bhikkhuni order are not necessarily applicable in today's circumstances. And if we think, then perhaps we could take the Thai forest tradition as our standard. This is the tradition that Achan Brahm and Achan Jnana and the monks at Bodhinyana have trained under Achan Cha in Thailand. Could we use that? And again, we have to see that it doesn't quite fit, because Achan Cha himself did not start a nun's order. There is actually no Achan Cha forest tradition for nuns directly from him. The community of nuns which practice in England, centred around Amaravati, practice in a situation, in a sangha, which was started by Achan Cha's senior disciple, Achan Sumedho. But again, that situation is not necessarily appropriate for us. In fact, they have themselves been evolving the form that the nuns community is going to take in England for the last 20 years, and it's constantly under revision as circumstances change. And when I stayed in England, one time the community members there, one of the monks was talking about the fact that rather than now having the Thai forest tradition, they had the English countryside tradition. And I think this is a nice thing to reflect on, because we can see that we have to modify our way of practice, the form, depending on the conditions that we are living in the present day. And another reason why the form or the standard that is practiced in Amaravati is not directly applicable to our situation here is because the community that they've developed for nuns is a community which lives in the same monastery with the bhikkhus. And the communities have been developed side by side. So the nuns who live in that community look to Achan Samedo as their preceptor and as their teacher, and to the senior monks in that community as their teachers also. And many of the formal procedures which govern the life of the nuns sangha include or take part are taken as part of a totality which includes the monks sangha as well. And in Perth, in our community here, it was always our intention from the very beginning that the nuns sangha and the monks sangha would live quite separately, that they would live in different monasteries, and that the monasteries would function independently and autonomously. So that form which is developed in England, while it provides us with some very good guidelines, doesn't actually address directly our situation here. So when we come to look at what we're doing here in Perth, we have to be, if you like, flexible and recognise that what we're doing is groundbreaking work, and that we're not necessarily going to have all the right answers right from the beginning. And I'd like to just read something, a paragraph from the Forest Sangha newsletter from England, which came recently, to emphasise that it's not just setting up a nun's order that's difficult, even setting up a monk's order in a new country is difficult. And this article is written by Achan Suchito, who is the abbot of Chittaviveka Monastery, which is the first monastery that was established by Achan Chah and his disciples in England 21 years ago. And so this article is talking about the 21 years that they've had for developing the monastic life there. Chittaviveka is 21 years old this year. Among the group of Achan Chah's monasteries that are currently in existence in Britain, this was the first to be established. It had the first ordination precinct, the first ordinations, and is the only monastery that has a sizeable area of forest attached to it. And now this is an article written by Achan Suchito, the third and current abbot, and he reports on the state of affairs in the year 2000. So this is his introduction. It used to be referred to as Chithurst Work Camp in the early days when we were slogging away at making the house livable. Then it was Chithurst Boot Camp when training conventions had to be laid down, although we were not clear as to what would work. It's not always the case that everything goes right first go. And with such a fledgling sangha in a non-Buddhist culture, there was a shortage of role models. It has always been, try this and see, with the requirement to learn from mistakes. When the precedents for monastic life were found in the remote provinces of Thailand, the know-how was bound to be slender, and the need for faith, resilience, and openness of mind high. Those three qualities established Chittaviveka have kept it going, and will, I hope, long continue to be its guiding lights, even when, as now, things seem settled and the land is vibrant with life and it seems to be Chithurst summer camp. So the point that makes is that we have to be open and flexible and see what works. But we do have a core or a foundation for the practice that we're going to have and that we do already have at Dharmasara. And that core are the 10 precepts, or is the 10 precepts. My ordination in Sri Lanka 16 years ago was as a 10 precept nun. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the 10 precepts, I'll just go through them. The first precept is to refrain from harming living beings. The second precept is to refrain from taking what is not given. The third precept is celibacy, to refrain from any kind of erotic behaviour. The fourth precept is to refrain from wrong speech. The fifth precept is to refrain from using drugs and alcohol, which confuse the mind. The sixth precept is to refrain from taking food, solid food, after noon until dawn the following day. The seventh precept is to refrain from singing, dancing, music, and going to unseemly shows. The next precept is to refrain from using cosmetics and decorations to beautify the body. The next precept is to refrain from using high and luxurious bedding to live in a simple way. And the last precept, the tenth precept, is to refrain from using and accepting and having control over money of any kind for one's own use. So these 10 precepts, as you can see, some of them are similar or the same as the ones that you as lay people take, the 5 precepts. The two which are quite different and which mark the move from the household life to the homeless life are the third precept, celibacy, and the last precept, not to have any money, because that makes one completely dependent on the support of lay people. And so 10 precept nuns are alms mendicants in the same way that the bhikkhus are, who keep 227 rules. And I'd just like to reinforce that statement by reading just a couple of lines from an article that Achan Brahm wrote back in 1995, when he was talking about the possibility of setting up a nun's monastery here in Perth, and knowing the difficulty of finding some kind of standard form that was going to cover all the possibilities here. An alternative form to the bhikkhuni ordination, which was the full ordination instituted by the Buddha, that has been developing in many countries is the 10 precept nun, the Dasa Sila Mata, or the Dasa Sila Dara. Through observing celibacy, the third of the 10 precepts, and not receiving money or things used as money, the 10th of the 10 precepts, the 10 precept nun keeps the two essential rules basic to the Buddhist monastic life of renunciation. Many 10 precept nuns diligently observe many other rules beyond these 10, thus giving them a complete monastic rule similar to that of the monk. I have been asked the question, how can you expect to have the same respect that the monks have when you only keep 10 precepts and the monks keep 227? And I think that's a good question for people to reflect on. And I want to make the point, I guess, in this talk tonight, that although the 10 precepts are the core of our practice and the guidelines, they're the core of our renunciation of the home life and also the surrender to the training of a monastic, they are not the only framework for our practice. And I'm going to come back later at the end of the talk to just show how these two precepts have quite a bearing on our practice, and particularly also on your practice as lay people. But just to inform you that as well as those 10 precepts, nuns who take the 10 precept ordination are bound in the same way as monks by the 4 parajikas, or the 4 offences, which if you commit them, you are no longer a monk or a nun. And the first of these 4 parajikas is to intentionally kill a human being. The second one is to engage in sexual intercourse with any living being, same sex or an animal, or the opposite sex, all the same. To intentionally steal anything which would, in civil court, would cause you to be charged with a crime. And lastly, to falsely claim, knowingly claim, any high attainments, saying that, for example, that you meditate at such and such a level, or that you have psychic powers, knowing those things to be false. Now, for a parajika to be committed, there has to be the intention to commit, there has to be the action, action to accomplish, and the act has to be accomplished for the parajika to be complete. And if you commit any of those offences, you are no longer held to be a nun. And so we have that as our bottom line, if you like. And within that, there are a number of offences that can be committed, which can be punished, but which you can be rehabilitated from. So there are grades of offences, but these are the 4 offences from which you cannot be rehabilitated. So when we're looking at the precepts and the way that we're going to develop the nun's form here, I think if we recognise that there is an absolute standard that you can't go beyond, but anything, any mistakes made within that sort of framework can be rehabilitated. But the 10 precepts are to be held very tightly. As well as the 4 causes for defeat, there are also the relationship that we have to the 4 requisites. And the 4 requisites for a monk and a nun are the robes to cover the body, food as medicine to keep the body healthy and alive, shelter to protect from the weather and from animals and insects, and medicines to support the life and to alleviate pain. And these 4 requisites for a nun, the same as for the monk, come through the generosity of the lay people who support us. And we are not permitted to ask for things except from our family or from people who have made the offering to us that they want to be someone who can supply any of these 4 requisites. And there's a whole procedure that is around any of the ways that we acquire the requisites that we need and the way that they are used in the community. So, for example, the only personal property that a nun has is her 1 set of robes and her bowl. And everything else is communal. And that means that we have a special relationship to the robe and the bowl. They are things which we have to treat with particular respect and care. And there are particular procedures for how we go about attaining another one when the one that we're using is worn out or lost or whatever. So all of these procedures are the same as for the monks. And it means that as well as the precepts that we keep, there are also these procedures and standards which have to be followed. And within the community of nuns, part of the the training, is to live in harmony and to live in a way which encourages and fosters our commitment to the practice. And so there are regular meetings of the community. There's a regular procedure for the confession of breaking of the precepts, for confessing what's been done and for receiving rehabilitation from those breaches of our training rules. So all of those things are also there, and they, if you like, support the core precepts, the 10 precepts. But as I said, here in Perth, we have a situation which is still evolving, because at the moment we don't have a sangha of nuns. We don't have a community that we can relate to. So at the moment, I'm it. And those people who come in to the community will first of all be relating directly to me. And the way that we train is that when someone wants to come to join the community, first of all, they will come for 6 months so that they have the chance to see whether the monastic life is what they think it's going to be and whether it's for them. And for those 6 months, they will train in keeping the 8 precepts. The 8 precepts include celibacy, but they allow the person to retain control over their own money. And so, especially for people who are coming to the monastic life later in life, very often they have accumulated material possessions, they have accumulated wealth, and so it would be foolish to make a decision right at the beginning that you're going to get rid of it all and give it away, when after 6 months you may decide this isn't really for me. So there's a 6 month opportunity to live on 8 precepts as a lay woman in the monastery. And then after that 6 months, if you decide that you would like to continue training further, then the opportunity is there to request to be given ordination as a novice, to be formally taken as a candidate for future ordination. And again, you would stay on 8 precepts, but at that point the candidate would shave their head and wear more monastic-like robes, and they would start to really train in the precepts, still keeping the 8 precepts, including celibacy, not eating after 12, but having control over their own money. So for another 18 months after that point, they would train in the monastery, and they would have really the opportunity to see whether this is what they want to do. Because the crunch comes when you take the 10 precepts, because at that time, if you decide that that's what you want to do, you have to dispose of your material possessions, your worldly wealth, and become completely dependent on the community of lay supporters for your well-being, for the requisites of your life. And so this is why it's important for people to have a gradual training, not to jump in the deep end right from the beginning. And it's been the experience of the community in England that sometimes people, after 2 years, still aren't sure if that's what they want to do. And so they request a longer stay on the 8 precepts so they can really make up their mind. And also sometimes the community of nuns have felt after 2 years that someone is still not really ready. Because it's not just a matter of wanting to do it, it's a matter of really being able to surrender to the rules, to the form, to those things which are necessary in order to live in harmony with a group of people whom you haven't necessarily chosen because you like them. You all just happen to be living in the same place. You may have the same aspirations, but the how you express that in the way that you do things and the way that you get on with each other, all of this can often be a cause for conflict amongst the people who are living together. And so it's not just a matter of whether I feel I'm ready, it's a matter of whether the community feels that you're going to be someone who fits in to the group. So that's basically the way that we will approach training here. that people come and stay for 2 years in the monastery, and then after those 2 years they have the opportunity to request ordination as a 10 precept nun. Now just to move on to how celibacy and dependence are central to the life of a monastic and why they have relevance to you as lay people in your practice. When the Buddha instituted the monastic life, he did so because he said this is the best way of attaining Nibbana. This is setting up the best conditions because you're giving your whole attention to liberation. And if you think about it, it's like those athletes that you saw performing at the Olympic Games. They were doing the same things that many of us would have been doing, swimming in the water or running along or jumping or whatever, but they were doing it a whole lot better, a whole lot faster, a whole lot higher, because they were fully putting their whole life on the line, spending their whole day making that the centre of what they were doing. And so although they were doing the same things that you and I would be doing, they were doing them a whole lot better. And that's what is the point of the monastic life in that sense, is it's giving you the opportunity to become a full-time professional rather than to be doing it in your spare time. That doesn't mean that we don't, as monastics, have responsibilities and things to attend to, but it means that we're trying to include all of those things in our practice. The other reason that the monastic life is so important is because it allows you to live with like-minded people. The people who come to the monastery and who choose that kind of lifestyle all basically have the same aspirations and see the same things as important. And so you're living in a situation where people recognise the value of what you're doing, appreciate it and want to support it. And that is a great uplift for the heart. But the other reason why the monastic life is so important to our practice and to the attainment of Nibbana is because living the monastic life and conforming to the standards and the rules challenges the very heart of what keeps us bound to samsara. Having to surrender, having to renounce those things which are most precious to us. Not only the outer things, but the inner things as well. And so this is the part that I'd like to end on tonight, as you reflect on what keeps me stuck. Not just what keeps me stuck in my job or in my family or whatever, but what keeps me stuck to birth and death. And if we look at this, we see that the form of the monastic life, the precepts, the standards, are all encouraging us, first of all, to simplify. They're encouraging us to not get so distracted and not to look so much for happiness in the senses, not to have so many opportunities to indulge in pleasure, to take us away from what's really going on in our own body and mind. To help us to develop mindfulness. And not only mindfulness when we're sitting on the cushion, meditating, but to make the whole of our daily life, the whole of our relationship to the material world, part of our practice. To help to guard the mind from all of the temptations that come to us through the senses, so the mind has at least a chance to settle down and develop some clarity and peace, so that we can use this clarity and peace to develop insight and wisdom. And if we look particularly at the way that we do this, drawing the mind inward, we can see that the form and the standards that we follow in the monastery are all supports, but that doesn't mean that it's easy going, because they're challenging the habits, the ways that we've been normally seeking happiness in our life. The Buddha gave a number of reflections that he said monks and nuns should do very often to remind us of why we're doing what we're doing. And the first of these reflections is the reflection, I am no longer living according to worldly aims and values. Of course, very often we find that it's the worldly aims and values that we're living out in our life, even in the monastery. So what are these worldly aims and values that are being challenged? Well, one of them is our individuality. In the monastery, everyone dresses the same. Everyone looks basically the same. You can hardly tell us apart until you get up close or you hear us speak. And in the ordinary world, we exert our individuality by the way we dress, the way we walk, the way we talk, all of those things. And yet, in monastic life, we've got rules or standards about all of those things. We've got 75 Sakya training rules which govern how we should sit and how we should eat and how we should walk and how we should talk. And that's why we pretty much all look alike, because we're all trying to follow those standard rules. And in the worldly life, we often judge our value by our material success. I can choose, I can maximize my options, I can have what I want. And who do we put on a pedestal? Who do we think is great? We think the people who are rich enough to do what they like, to go where they want to do it when they want to. And yet in the monastery, we've given up all that. We don't have the option of showing how good a person we are by how much we've accumulated, or the quality of our robe or the quality of our bowl, for example, is no reflection on our material prosperity and therefore our success in life. And so these are very fundamental challenges to who we think we are and how we think we express who we are in the world. The other one that's very much part of our individuality and who we think we are is how much control we have over our daily life. How much we can control what we're going to eat today, or how we're going to spend our time, or how we're going to dress for this particular occasion. And of course, all of those things are standardized or taken out of our control as monastics. We eat at a certain time. We eat what's given. We don't choose. And many of the routines of the monastery really do just grind away and grind you down, because every day is the same. Weekends are the same as the middle of the week, and holidays are the same as ordinary days. And it's that relentless grind which very often is what drives you nuts at times. And these are, again, these things challenge us. We like a little bit of change in our life. We like a little bit of excitement. And if I can change it the way I want it to be, that shows what a good person I am, or what a competent person I am, or how big a person I am. All of that is lost. Another aspect of the monastic life, as you've noticed, the monks and nuns also look alike. They wear the same kind of clothes, they shave their head the same, they shave their eyebrows even in this tradition. And this again is a challenge to who we think we are. For the females, it's a challenge to our femininity, our idea of what makes a woman, to have lovely hair, to be able to dress in clothes that flatter, not clothes that make you look dowdy, or the colour doesn't suit my complexion. What can I do about that? That kind of thing. And for the males, just as much, it's to challenge the idea of masculinity, because monks are men who are walking around in skirts. What kind of man can they be? And also, just the sort of robes that we wear, if you're not careful, they fall off. You've got to be mindful about how you use the body and how quickly you move and whether you get up in the right way. All of these things encourage mindfulness moment by moment, but they also challenge the concept of who I am as a person if I'm not an individual. And of course this brings us to the idea of celibacy. Celibacy which is so central to the monastic life. And I've spoken about this previously because very often people think that celibacy is a turning away from other people, a turning away from life. But in fact, that's quite the opposite. Because practicing celibacy, there are the two aspects of celibacy. The first is the renunciation of the physical gratification that comes through sexuality. That is one aspect of the renunciation of celibacy. And that's quite a big one. You can ask yourselves, all of you, how big a renunciation would that be for you? But the second aspect of the renunciation that comes with celibacy is the renunciation of having that special person in your life, that special relationship. And for most people, if you reflect on how you came to be with the person you're with or how you got married or whatever, you'll know that at a certain time in your life, nature was just pushing you to find a partner. And it was pushing you to find a partner because there was some sense that then you would be complete. Then you would be whole. Then you would be fulfilled. And if you didn't find that in your partner, then you had a few kids as well. The children also contributed to that feeling of completion. And so we're looking outside. We're looking to another, to a few others sometimes, to help us to feel complete. And as we do that, as we continually look out, very often we find that that person hasn't satisfied, hasn't fulfilled us. There's still something missing, and so it's sort of like relationship after relationship, or a feeling of unfulfillment within. With celibacy, we are no longer looking outside for that feeling of completion. We're no longer thinking that that completion can be found out there, but then we have to practice to be complete within ourselves. And this is a real challenge. This is a challenge that goes on throughout the monastic life. And it's in a sense, letting go of what everyone else is saying is where you'll find fulfillment, and trusting that you'll find fulfillment somewhere else. Maybe you haven't found it there yet, but you have the faith and the confidence that the practice will take you there. And as you find this completion or fulfillment within yourself, independent of others out there, then the consequence of that is that you are able to turn to everyone and every being as though they were that special person. So it's not just to be complete within oneself. The next step is to then embrace the whole of life as being just as special, just as important as all of you might think your partner or your children are to you. And I'd just like to read a small verse which I think says this very nicely. And maybe I'm not trying to convince any of you, but I know that there are some of you here who are interested in pursuing the monastic life. And so this might just if you like, give you a little bit of hope that it's worth the effort. The experience of being alone, when one is one with all, provides a key for the understanding of celibacy. The sister sustains the paradox which others experience only in a brief moment. She is alone so as to be truly one with all. Or one could also say that she is so deeply united with all that solitude is paradoxically the only adequate expression for this unity. Of course, this is what we're aspiring to, and this is why it's a challenge. You touch it from time to time, and then it's gone. So you have to do more work. But that's what we're aspiring to achieve through giving up something which is very precious. The other aspect of not living according to worldly aims and values is to try to make the whole of our life our practice, and not to see that some things are pleasant and I like to do them, and there are some things which I don't like to do, and that's not the practice, that's not part of my practice. Or to think that my practice is only when I'm sitting on the meditation cushion. The way that the form and the procedures of monastic life operate, the way that we relate to the four requisites, for example, means that we're constantly trying to be mindful of the way we mentally relate to the world around us and the way that we use that world in accordance with our aspiration for simplicity and harmlessness and being satisfied and content with what we have. And this plays itself out in the strangest ways. So just to give you an example, now that we're building our nun's cottage, we're talking about what kind of washing machine should we put in there. And if some people, of course, say, well, you should have the best, you should have an automatic washing machine. That's what would be really good. But from the monastic point of view, an automatic washing machine might be nice, but it's not actually in keeping with our lifestyle. Because what happens when you have a washing machine that you just press the buttons for is that you don't always relate to the washing machine as doing your dirty washing. Your dirty washing arises because of your dirty body. And it's very easy to lose touch of that when you can take off your clothes and wear them once or twice and just put them in the washing machine and back they come fresh. You don't actually notice what this dirty body produces and how much work it is to keep it clean and how much work it is to keep your clothes clean if you can just shove them in the washing machine and forget about them. So we want to be, as monastics, in touch with the realities of this body. And so an automatic washing machine takes us away from that, unless you're mindful, of course. Also, we have to be aware of the fact that we don't have a week's clothing to wear. We can't let the basket get full and then put all the things in together and keep on taking stuff out of the cupboard. We've only got a limited amount. So we want to have it washed and back on our backs pretty quickly. So the compromise is to get a washing machine that's a twin tub. So you can wash in the machine, but you can you have to stand there and you have to do your washing and you have to be aware of how long it's going to take you and what's involved in keeping these things clean. The other thing is that living in a community, which we will be eventually, other people will want to use the washing machine. And so how do you work out the strategies for harmoniously using the washing machine? And all of these things are not just things outside of our practice. They're not irrelevancies. These are the way that we put into practice or bring the practice into all the aspects of our daily life. And what happens as a result of that is that instead of having some things are pleasant and other things are terrible, everything comes eventually to be terrible. No, that's not true. Everything comes to be in the middle somewhere. Neither so terrible, neither so pleasant. We're able to remain fairly equanimous with whatever is happening for us. And this is a great benefit when we come to our meditation. Because in our meditation, we have to be content with the way things are. We have to be on that even keel. We have to be able to bear with what is unpleasant in the posture or in what's arising in our thoughts and not get bowled over by it. Neither to just seek those states of mind which are wonderful. That's all I want in my meditation. However it is, that's what we've got to work with. So this contentment and this moving, this smoothing out so things are no longer up and then down is a very important support for the meditation practice. Now, unfortunately, I've come to the end of the time. I had more to say. There's a lot more to this life than meets the eye. And I guess the thing that I would like to leave with you is the fact that what's happening here in Perth is groundbreaking and it's evolving. We don't know exactly how to do everything completely from step to step, but we're doing our best. And the one thing that I would like to just remind you of is how important it is to have female role models of in the monastic life available to everyone, but particularly to those of you females who aspire to attain Nibbana. I was looking back through the old issues of the Buddhist Society newsletter just to get some idea of the history of how the nuns' monastery comes to be. And what I noticed is that in 1995, Sister Jitindria, who's based in the community in England, came to visit Perth. And the fact that here was a nun, a flesh and blood nun, who was living the monastic life and who was doing it well, really inspired people, really encouraged them, really opened their eyes to the fact that maybe this is possible. And the Buddhist Society had from its inception, as part of its constitution, the intention to set up monastic facilities for females. But it was after Sister Jitindria's visit, and that coincided with the monks' monastery being well established, the debts being paid off here, that people said, okay, a nun's monastery is a possibility. There are nuns around. Let's do it. And so the fact that she came really set the ball rolling. And I like to think that the fact that we now have a nun's monastery and we have nuns, that all of you who are aspiring to practice the Buddha's teaching for the attainment of Nibbana will also think, let's do it. We can do it. And that's my hope for all of us. May this teaching tonight and the sharing of this practice help us all to attain Nibbana. Does anyone have any questions? Right. The question is, how do you know that you're not deluding yourself, that you think you're becoming more peaceful and at one because you've withdrawn from relationships, intimate relationships, but you're actually just becoming more, I guess, self-centered and deluded? And one of the things is your own inner experience. You have to be becoming more peaceful. That's a very good sign. And not just peaceful when you're on your own, but peaceful in your context with people and with circumstances in your life. So the Buddha's teaching is always to reflect on your own experience. And this is one of the attitudes of mind that we are constantly trying to encourage and develop, is to go back to your own experience. And if you think that you're being one with all, but you're more miserable and your relationships with people are less harmonious, then obviously something's not right. And also that's the feedback that you get from other people. If you are not relating to them with love and kindness, then you'll get that feedback from them. And That's one of the benefits of monastic life. You live with the same people, you work with the same people, you're together all the time. There's nowhere to hide. So you get the feedback pretty quickly.